Science is the great antidote to the poison of enthusiasm and superstition. Hi, I'm Juliette Selgren, and this is my podcast, The Great Antidote, named for Adam Smith, brought to you by Liberty Fund. To learn more, visit www.adamsmithworks.org. Welcome back. It is my pleasure to be talking to Colin Grabow today on November 4th, 2022. He's been on the podcast once already to talk about the Jones Act, which is a form of a law specifically about trade protectionism. And we're going to be talking more about that today because there have been some recent developments. He's a research fellow at the Cato Institute at the Center for Trade Policy Studies, and that's where he focuses on trade protectionism. I feel like there's been a renewed interest on both sides of the aisle recently, or at least it's been back in the news more than it has. So we'll get into that. Welcome back.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Juliette. It's been a while. So thanks for having me back on the podcast.
So before we jump into things like treason, what is the most important thing that people my age or in my generation should know that we don't?
It's a good question. And it's hard to answer because I don't know what people your age, your generation don't know. My impression is people from your generation actually know quite a bit. So I can only, offer kind of a guess here. But if I was to give some advice right now or try to share a little nugget of insight beyond the Jones Act and why it's terrible, I would just say there's a lot of opportunity out there that I think people don't always fully recognize. I think a lot of times people say when they're looking for jobs or a career, they think, I want to do that. And to do that, I need to work for this type of organization. And there's these organizations function as gatekeepers, and you have to, get your foot in the door somehow and get past them. But also, certainly, that's one way to go about things. But if you don't see opportunities at some of these companies or places you don't work for, try to create your own opportunities. And if you don't see an open door, make your own door, put a hole in the wall. For example, you think there's a topic that is not being covered or a perspective that isn't out there and that you think is missing. Well, do it yourself. Start your own podcast. It's not as lots of people are doing it. The barriers aren't tremendously high, but as podcast is one example. Before I worked at the Cato Institute, I used to write my own blog about my perspectives on trade issues. My boss, Scott Linsicum, he did the same thing. And I know other people at Cato that kind of got their start in the public policy world, just scribbling on Facebook and offering their opinions and perspectives. And that got noticed by other people, that elevated their profile. So, I think this applies particularly to, the world of journalism, public policy. But again, there's a lot of opportunity out there. Don't just think that you have to go through an existing organization to share your perspective in the world. There's a lot of opportunities out there for you to do it yourself without asking permission from other people and use that at least as a starting point. So, yeah, again, just don't limit yourself and think of there are a lot more opportunities out there than people might appreciate.
That's some really good advice and timely, at least for me. I've been thinking a lot about the future. It's like course selection time. And it's like, what do you need for grad school? And what do you need for this? And what do you need to take if you want this sort of job and this, that, and the other thing? And so it's good for me to hear that at least. Except listeners, don't start a podcast because then I'm going to have to like go lobby the government and get some barriers to entry because I don't want competition. Except that obviously I'm kidding because I'm pro competition. So go ahead, actually. So let's get into things like barriers to entry. Can you quickly remind us what the Jones Act is?
Yes, the Jones Act is Section 27 of the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, which essentially says if you want to move something within the United States from one part of the United States to another by water, you have to use a vessel that is flagged and registered in the United States as opposed to a foreign country. It has to be at least 75% owned by American citizens. It has to be crewed by Americans. And the vessel itself has to be built here in the United States. That's a very unusual requirement. You know, we do have similar prohibitions or restrictions on, say, you know, airlines and trucking. You can't take a foreign airline between two U.S. cities, but you can use a foreign-built airplane, you know, an Airbus, for example, and there's no problem with that. But when it comes to shipping, we have this very draconian law that severely limits competition for water transport here in the United States.
And why do we have that?
Well, it depends who you ask. My answer is basically, like many protectionist laws, this enriches a relatively small number of people here in the United States. Of course, you know, shipyards, they love this law. It says, you know, you have to buy what they make. You can't buy from foreigners. U.S. shipping companies, they don't want to compete with foreign shipping companies, et cetera. But if you want to get in, you know, a little bit in the history, the background of this law, you know, as I mentioned, this law was passed in 1920, but it's not as though pre-1920 we had this laissez-faire environment where you could use any ship, anything went. In fact, we've had similar laws like this going back to the beginning of the country, back to 1789, but back then, the context was very, very different. Back then, U.S. shipbuilders were some of the world's best and cheapest. This is, of course, the era of wooden ships. We had lots of wood, big forests here, so lots of plentiful timber to make ships out of. And also back then, the U.S. new country, we were a relatively poor country. Our biggest rivals were the British. They had a huge navy. We did not. So to encourage the use of U.S. ships was important because you could take just everyday, you know, merchant ships and you could load them with cannon and kind of turn them into an instant navy. But obviously we live in a far different world today than we did then. The world has changed tremendously. The maritime world has changed tremendously, but our laws have not.
And, I mean, who cares? Like, we don't ship things that much, even if it's because of the Jones Act, whatever. But apparently, the government really cares. So a few weeks ago, the Dispatch reported that according to a set of FOIA'd documents, can I say FOIA'd? I'm going to keep saying
it. You can. No, it's a verb. Yeah.
So a set of those FOIA'd documents from the Maritime Administration basically said that all of the Cato Institute and the Mercatus Center should be charged with treason for criticizing the Jones Act. This is a little intense. Can you tell us the backstory and a little bit more about that?
Yes. So as you mentioned, the Cato Institute, we've filed some requests through the Freedom of Information Act for information, emails from the U.S. Maritime Administration. And they gave us hundreds of pages of documents we were going through, but we noticed that a lot of these documents had areas that were redacted, where they kind of, you know, blacked out. And under the Freedom of Information Act, government doesn't have to give you everything. There are certain privileges they can invoke and say, no, that's, you know, confidential information, or this is what we call deliberative process privilege, and we don't have to provide that to you. Well, my colleague Patrick Eddington and I were going through these emails, and Patrick said, you know, I think some of these privileges they're invoking, I don't quite buy it. I want to challenge them on it. So we did. We challenged them and said, no, we'd like to see this information. And the Maritime Administration grudgingly said, yes, okay, we'll give you some of that. You're correct on some of these challenges. But they kept dragging their heels on actually coughing up the documents. Patrick threatened them with legal action. And then suddenly they produced these documents, I think back in August or so. Well, going through the documents, it included, there was 41 pages of material. On page 40, there was a three-page summary of different recommendations from something called the Maritime Transportation System National Advisory Committee. This is a committee comprised of people from the maritime industry that advises the Maritime Administration on different issues. Well, if you look at these different bullet points and recommendations they had, get to one section and says We need lots of cargo to get cargo. We need lots of we need the Jones Act. And oh, but you know, says unequivocal support of the Jones Act. Sub bullet point under that: charge all past and present members of the Cato and Mercatus Institutes with treason. Went on to add, the president informed the Heritage Institute, or should I say the Heritage Foundation, that he will personally disavow them if they continue to advocate against the Jones Act. Obviously, this is remarkable. Some people may think this is a joke. It may, maybe it was, but it wasn't apparent from the way it was written. And furthermore, you just have to ask yourself, this is the kind of thing that people in a government committee write down. What kind of conversations are they having in private if this is what they feel comfortable with, you know, expressing in written form?
That's so... What does it even mean? Like, can they act on something like that? Is that constitutional? They absolutely cannot.
They absolutely cannot. It is thoroughly unconstitutional. I'm kind of disappointed they didn't try to come to Cato and arrest all of us. It would have been quite the PR spectacle. I would love to have that trial. We talk about the Jones Act. No, I think you know, the larger significance here is it just speaks to a certain mentality for just daring to question the wisdom of the Jones Act. This is seen as, you know, by some people, maybe there's an element of humor here, maybe not, as tantamount to treason. I think there's no interpretation of this that doesn't conclude that the people that wrote this, even if in jest, they obviously have strong feelings about this, and they think that for organizations such as Cato and Mercatus to question the Jones Act is beyond the pale. And that's disturbing. That's just a very disturbing mentality to have, that we can't even talk about it. You can't broach the subject. And that's wrong.
So let's question the wisdom of the Jones Act really quickly. Can you remind us of the costs associated with the Jones Act?
Yeah, we you know, time is limited, so I can't get into all of them. But you know, just to give the try to briefly summarize, Jones Act ships, the ships themselves. Let's start with that. Building ships in the United States, you have to use U.S. built ships. It's incredibly expensive. U.S. built ships are considered to be container ships, about five times more expensive than ones built in other countries. Earlier this week, there was an order placed for three Jones Act ships, for $1 billion. Now, to give you some context here, these ships their cargo capacity is 3,600 TEUs. A TEU is a 20-foot equivalent unit. Most, you know, cargo containers are 40 feet, so that'd be two TEUs. So these are 3,600 TEUs ships. Last month, there was an order placed from a South Korean shipyard for six ships of 17,000 TEUs. So, you know, something like, you know, four times the capacity of these others. And you got, you know, six of them instead of three. Last year, there was an order placed for 24 ships from a Chinese shipyard for $1 billion, with cargo capacities ranging from 18 TEUs to 3,000 TEUs. What's more interesting is that this same shipyard built this exact same type of ship a few years ago. They got an order for this type of ship about 9 years ago. And back then, back in 2013, they paid $209 million per ship. And now we're up to $330 million per ship over, you know, 10 years. So this is massive cost escalation. And of course, this gets translated into higher shipping rates. Ships are very expensive to build. They're expensive to crew. These American crews make something like five times more than their foreign counterparts. U.S. ships are about three times more expensive to operate than foreign ships. So you take ships that are very expensive to build, very expensive to operate, and the inevitable result is very expensive shipping, which is why in this country, we basically don't use ships, or we use them very little. We basically only use ships as a last resort. For example, if you need to ship something to Hawaii or Puerto Rico, Alaska, Guam, where, you know, you can't take a truck, you can't use rail, you have to use a ship, then use a Jones Act ship. In fact, earlier this week, I saw an article from Bloomberg talking about the northeast of the United States right now has a shortage of diesel fuel, where there's escalating prices for diesel fuel. And it said the prices have gone up so much that actually two Jones Act tankers were used to transport fuel from the Gulf Coast, where we have a lot of our refineries, up to the Northeast. Now, think about that for a second. Normally, shipping is considered a very efficient way of moving goods from point A to point B. But in the United States, we've made it an act of desperation. Things are so expensive, it actually justified using a Jones Act ship. That's how crazy things have gotten.
Listeners, to hear more stories and hear more about the costs of the Jones Act, go listen to our original interview. I'm pretty sure it's just called Colin Grabo on the Jones Act. We hear a lot about the Jones Act, especially during times of emergency, like the hurricane that just went through Puerto Rico in September. Can you tell us about what happened in the wake of that hurricane and what role the Jones Act played?
Yes. So as you mentioned, in September, which is almost exactly 5 years after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico in 2017. So we had another hurricane, Hurricane Fiona, hit Puerto Rico. And Puerto Rico's electrical system went down. There were widespread power outages. And so a lot of people turned to generators, which use diesel fuel to meet their electricity needs. So a couple of days after the hurricane hit, there was a company in Puerto Rico that asked British Petroleum if they could send some diesel to Puerto Rico. Well, there happened to be a ship with 300,000 barrels of diesel fuel already on its way from Texas to Europe. And the ship got diverted to Puerto Rico because they had lots of diesel fuel. Puerto Rico needed diesel fuel. At least his company requested the diesel fuel. And the ship showed up, but it could not unload its cargo. Well, what was the problem? Well, the problem is that it was flagged in the Marshall Islands. It was a South Korean-built foreign flag ship, did not comply with the Jones Act. So it had to sit there offshore for a few days until eventually a waiver of the Jones Act was granted by the Biden administration that allowed its cargo to be unloaded. But we have to, you know, step back and think about the absurdity of this. This is just a ship trying to transport American cargo. This is from Texas to Americans in need. And it was prevented from doing so by the Jones Act. And this is kind of, you know, the Jones Act writ large. It gets in the way of Americans doing business with other Americans and trading with other Americans. But in this case, just providing disaster relief and an urgently needed good to other Americans.
What sort of stuff do you need to do to be able to get a special pass or a waiver to overcome the barriers of the Jones Act during an emergency?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there was actually quite an outcry over this waiver. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of criticism of the waiver from Jones Act supporters in Congress. Because if you look at the letter of the law, the way it's supposed to work is first the company says, I need to ship this item from here to there. There are no American ships available. And, oh, this is also for national security reasons. This, you know, this undermines our national defense if I can't, you know, move this product. So the way the process is supposed to work is the U.S. Maritime Administration conducts a survey to make sure that there are no American ships available. And then it also has to be decided that, yes, this does meet the national defense requirement. Now, that's not spelled out exactly what constitutes national defense. So, you know, this is more art than science. I think it's a very politicized decision as to whether something constitutes national defense or not. And ultimately, then the Department of Homeland Security can provide that waiver if it meets those two requirements. No U.S. ships and there's a national defense is impacted. Well, the DHS, when they granted that waiver, the ship was already underway, right? It already left Texas on its way to Europe when it went over to Puerto Rico. So it was very hard. You can't do a survey to see if there are available American ships. And then also in its granting of the waiver, the announcement made no mention of how this was related to national security. So my colleague Scott Linsicum and I actually had an op-ed the other day about this. And yes, by the letter of the law, there are some questions over whether this waiver should be granted. But the solution here, obviously, is that we have far too restrictive of a waiver system. This is, you know, Americans in need. We should, the Jones Act should not be a barrier. We should be removing barriers, making it as easy as possible to speed aid to those that, that need it. And but in contrast, we have members of Congress that they're, what they're offended about is that the waiver was granted at all. So it's really perverse what's going on here.
It kind of reminds me of occupational licensing, especially in the medical profession during COVID, where they took down a bunch of red tape because it just was hard to get care to people because of all these rules. And my the big thing that I saw through that was, like, if you have to take down these rules in a time of emergency, doesn't that mean that the rule is kind of useless or bad or just, like, overall inefficient, not helpful, or doesn't reach its aim in terms of quality and out and reach and all of that stuff? It seems kind of similar in this case, that if you have, if you, if the waiver makes it more difficult in the time of an emergency, it's still possible, but it's a lot more difficult. Shouldn't it just, I don't know, like, they didn't even really cut it down in this case, but it just seems kind of glaringly obvious.
Exactly, exactly. It's times like this, an emergency, that, you know, the lunacy of some of these laws and restrictions are highlighted. And that's when it becomes glaringly obvious how bad it is, which I think is why the administration granted that waiver, because they could see that the absurdity of, you know, a needed product waiting offshore can't be delivered because of this law. But then the emergency passes and, you know, we go back to punching ourselves in the face, you know, with these and harming ourselves through these kinds of restrictions. So you would think that in a situation like this, when the harm is highlighted, that we should, the conversation should then move on to, well, let's get rid of this law, or at least, you know, substantially reform it. But unfortunately, that doesn't seem to typically be the case.
You've written a lot about how the Jones Act raises the cost of energy. Do you think that in the coming months that this is going to become a problem and that maybe this will be the thing that kills the Jones Act?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, right now we're seeing surging diesel prices in the northeast of the United States as supplies go down. And this is, it's interesting because at the same time, the U.S. is exporting lots of diesel fuel. It's not as though the United States as a whole lacks diesel fuel. We just lack it in this one part of the country. And we do have diesel fuel in other parts of the country, but our ability to get it there is severely hamstrung by the Jones Act, which makes, you know, costs very, very expensive. So, and beyond that example, we also have this winter, there's a lot of concern in New England that they will not have sufficient supplies or access to liquefied natural gas. New England lacks, they don't have enough pipelines carrying natural gas up there, so they have to turn to liquefied natural gas. So where you take natural gas, you freeze it, I think negative 260 degrees, turns into a liquid, and then you put it on a ship, and you can ship it and send it elsewhere. So New England uses a lot of LNG, and they can't buy American LNG because there are no tankers that comply with the Jones Act to transport it. There are zero, so it's literally impossible. We can export LNG to China, but we can't send it to New England because of the Jones Act. Same thing with Puerto Rico. They also use a lot of LNG, and they have to buy all of it from foreign countries. So that's a problem if you're New England. You need LNG, and the world's leading exporter is off the table when it comes to buying it. So we've seen there was a letter written by six New England governors in July to the administration asking basically what are the circumstances under which we can get a waiver of the Jones Act. I think yesterday there was a debate in which Representative Chris Pappas of New Hampshire said that he favors a waiver of the Jones Act so they can get LNG. I know that Governor Charlie Baker favors it. His Democratic opponent also favors a waiver of the Jones Act. So in recent weeks, between the hurricane hitting Puerto Rico, between the diesel situation, the coming winter, and uncertain supplies of LNG for New England. We're seeing a lot of talk about the Jones Act. Hopefully, you know, people will see when a law comes up over and over again, maybe this is a signal that we should do something about it. I'm not optimistic that will be the case, but we have definitely seen more chatter around this law than I think we have in quite some time.
And it's interesting because the Jones Act seems to be the sort of protectionist policy that many closed economy and like people who advocate for buying American and only American, they seem to be the ones advocating for things like the Jones Act. But then when it comes to energy and things like that, it seems to be the Jones Act that's getting in the way of the sort of thing that they want.
Yes. Yes, that's one of the great ironies of this. And I think it kind of shows, really highlights some of the problems with these Buy America laws. You know, on the surface, some people may look at the Jones Act and say, well, this is a great law. It says you have to use American ships built in the United States, crewed by Americans. That's wonderful. But then you have to compare it to the reality. And the Jones Act affects transportation. Transportation is a big deal, especially in a country the size of the United States that stretches from, you know, Guam to Puerto Rico and the Aleutian Islands to Maine. Distance is a barrier to trade. Overcoming that distance for Americans to effectively trade with each other, we need efficient transportation. And shipping in a country, especially in a country as big as the United States, should be a big part of the equation in meeting these transportation needs. And basically, it makes it more difficult for Americans to trade with each other, and actually, ironically, you know, tilts the playing field in favor of imports. And I'm a free trader. There's absolutely nothing wrong with buying imports, but I also don't understand why the U.S. government should be tilting the playing field in their direction, because imports, they can take advantage of efficient international shipping. They don't have to pay Jones Act shipping rates. So either we make it cheaper to buy foreign products once you factor in transportation because of the Jones Act, or in the case of, you know, LNG, it's impossible. You have no choice but to buy the foreign product. So I think people that are inclined towards economic nationalism really need to stop and think about this and really study the effects and how it's really imperiling domestic supply chains and reflect on that a bit.
It also seems to kind of prevent growth. I mean, I don't know what a world without the Jones Act would really look like, because we don't live in one. Like, you can guess, but in terms of numbers and economic growth for America, you don't entirely know what that's going to look like.
Yeah, you bring up an excellent point, which is, you know, nobody really knows the cost of the Jones Act. The federal government, in fact, has not even tried to put a number on that in 20 years. So we're kind of fumbling in the dark here a bit. And I think a lot of people make the mistake of thinking, well, the Jones Act, you know, that's a bad law, and that's too bad for people in Alaska or Puerto Rico. But, you know, I'm here in the mainland, not that big a deal. I can use a truck, I can use a rail. But, you know, the real cost of the Jones Act is, what does the United States look like with the Jones Act versus what does the United States look like without the Jones Act? And in the United States without the Jones Act, we can speculate a bit. We can imagine, for example, that we could have ships going up and down the East Coast, delivering goods, taking pressure off our highways and our rail systems, and leading to cheaper transportation, enabling domestic supply chains. You know, we have lots of major cities along our coast, you know, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, Miami, Charleston, et cetera. We should have, I think, a substantial shipping network, and we don't. And it makes sense when you think about the fact that we have this law that makes it very expensive to engage in shipping. Other countries, they pass measures, they subsidize their maritime industries and try to make it artificially cheaper. And here we make it artificially more expensive by a considerable amount. And transportation touches everything. It's so fundamental to how an economy works. So I think anybody that makes the mistake of thinking, well, I'm the contiguous, you know, 48 states, not a big deal, I think you're mistaken.
And it's not even just goods that, like, consumer goods. It's people, so cruise ships, and dredging, so other industries. Can you tell us about the Jones Act in relation to those sorts of things?
Yes. So the Jones Act applies to the transportation of goods, technically merchandise, between U.S. ports. But we also have other protections laws very similar to the Jones Act for things like cruises and dredging. Cruises fall under something called the Passenger Vessel Services Act, which traces itself back to 1886. and basically says that if you want to transport people between two U.S. ports, you have to use a U.S. flag, U.S. built ship. This is, we saw the PVSA come in the news last year when during COVID, Canada closed its ports to foreign, to cruise ships. And what happens is people that want to take cruises up to Alaska to get around the PVSA, the ship can be foreign and go to another part of the United States and come back, provided that it also includes a stop in a foreign port, making the voyage international as opposed to purely domestic. So we have lots of foreign cruise ships that go from, you know, Seattle up to Alaska, and they all stop in Canada along the way for a few hours to satisfy that requirement. Well, all of a sudden, Canadian ports are off limits. There's no Canadian port to stop in. You can't satisfy that requirement. And, you know, Alaska gets a huge percentage of its tourism revenue from cruises. So Congress last year suspended the PVSA for transportation between Washington State and Alaska for the duration of the cruise season of that year, so it wouldn't undercut its tourism industry. But then, like you said earlier, we look at these absurd situations in times of emergency, and we can see the cost is glaring, but then we go back to business as usual. And right now the PVSA is back in place.
So what is the point of that? Like, is it like a national security thing? Is it the same as the Jones Act in terms of the arguments for it?
Yeah. So the Jones Act, you know, to review real quickly, the arguments for it, people will say it is for national security, that the U.S. built requirement, for example, means that we build ships in our shipyards and keep U.S. shipyards in operation so that in time of war, they can build or repair ships for the Navy. And it means that we have a fleet of ships that can be used to transport goods for the military. And we have trained mariners to crew U.S. ships. I can get into why those are bad arguments, but those are the arguments. But it's even, and it's silly when you apply it, compare it to the results of the Jones Act, but it's even worse when you compare it to the PVSA. For these large cruise ships, we have not built a large cruise ship in the United States since the late 1950s. Okay, so that you're requiring a U.S. built cruise ship is silly, because this is not an industry that even exists in the United States. This is protectionism for nothing. And actually, the Canadians, they're big fans of this law. This is a law that drives business to their ports. I've seen accusations in the past or claims that the Canadian government actually lobbies for the law. They love it. And then cruises that go to Hawaii from the West Coast, they all stop in Mexico along the way to satisfy that requirement. So it's. I think the Jones Act obviously is a bad law, and the PVSA, if anything, is even worse because of the fact that when it comes to these large cruise ships, because we don't have any, there are smaller cruise ships you find in the U.S. that operate along the coast that have, you know, 150 people, something like this, or go on the Mississippi River. But these large cruise ships, you know, Carnival Cruises and whatnot, we don't even build those ships anymore, and we haven't for decades.
And how does the logic for that sort of regulation track?
Yeah, you know, it's a real head scratcher, and it's frustrating, of course, because when the failure is that glaring and the nonsense is that apparent, and, you know, we're literally in a position where, you know, we're not even giving shipyards any business here, and we're driving American tourism dollars to Canada. It's hard to get much more absurd than that. And of course, then the law had to be suspended last year for Alaska, and then we still return to business as usual. So it's enormously frustrating.
And how much more expensive does the PVSA make cruise ship traveling? I mean, my family is like a cruise ship family. We really like cruises, and so this is very relevant to me. How much more are we paying because of this sort of thing?
Yeah, so obviously, if it comes to sailing from the West Coast to Hawaii, you have to stop in Mexico. You know, it's just the extra fuel that the ship has to burn, you know, going, diverting from a more efficient normal course. I suspect that the costs are not humongous, but I think what we really should focus on are the costs to the tourism industry. For example, if ships didn't have to stop in Canada, they could spend more time in Alaska. And when you sign up for an Alaska cruise, isn't that kind of the point? Is to go to Alaska. And so it can more communities in Alaska, you can have more time there, more visits from cruise ships. You can also imagine scenarios like in the West Coast. Right now, there are no cruises that say go from San Diego up to San Francisco or Seattle and back. Again, they all have to incorporate foreign stops. So that's lost revenue for all those communities in California that could benefit from tourism stops. So those there are many costs. I suspect that the cost to your average person engaged in a cruise is minimal. But let me actually back up a second. That's for ocean cruises. But let's also think about river cruises. Right now, there is Viking Cruises, which is well known for its cruises in Europe. They started offering service in the United States through a subsidiary because the PVSA, they can't, they're a foreign company. They can't run these cruises directly. So they have an American subsidiary. And they built their first cruise ship to operate on the Mississippi River, and it cost $170 million. Well, their cruise ships that operate, or I should say vessels that operate on European rivers, I found an article from about a decade ago that said the most expensive ships were around $30-some million.
Wow.
Obviously, these are not the exact same ships, but but it's also instructive that Viking, when they first said they were going to get in this business, they anticipated the ship costing $90 to $100 million. They ended up spending $170 million. And if you just compare how much these cruise ships, these Mississippi cruises cost versus one of an equivalent length on the Rhine or the Danube, they're at least double, some of them are triple, quadruple. They're extremely expensive. And I can't help but think that the fact they're paying out the nose for these this new vessel factors into that.
I can't believe I'm missing out on cruises up the California coast or something. It's not like money that I'm paying that I'm losing so much as it's an opportunity cost. Because we have this, I don't get to even choose to experience river cruises or coastal cruises. Or, I mean, it's even bad for the American economy. Like, I went on a cruise to Alaska once and we did stop in Canada. Or we started in Canada or something like that.
Yeah.
It's the only time I've been to Canada.
I'm sure Canada appreciated your visit.
I would have never been to Canada if not for the Jones Act. All right, so I have one last question for you. What is one thing that you believed at one time in your life that you later changed your position on, and why?
Yeah, I gave this some thought, and one issue or position that I've changed is actually the death penalty. I used to be a strong supporter of it, tough on crime, people get what they deserve, et cetera, et cetera. And I oppose the death penalty now. And basically it's because, not even on moral grounds so much, is I just lack faith in the government to ensure that only guilty people suffer that punishment. And we've just seen too much abuse in the criminal justice system. I just don't have the confidence in the government to be in charge of something as important as life or death. And I think that more broadly, I see a lot of critics of government or advocates for limited government, and they are very aware of government shortcomings in numerous areas, but then they have certain blind spots. For example, with criminal justice, they think that the government screws lots of things up. They question their competence, but then when it comes to something like criminal justice, they think, oh, the government does a great job, or we should trust the police, etc. And I think we need to be aware of the fact that government doesn't stop, all the shortcomings and limitations of government don't stop when it comes to these other certain areas. So that's something that I've, beyond the death penalty, just criminal justice more broadly, and a lot of the shortcomings of government and trusting it with force and all the complications that come along with that. It's something that I urge lots of people to look up and just at least, if nothing else, become more aware of and read about.
Have you seen the statistics on that? I'm pretty sure it's like 1 in 7 people who are put on death row are actually innocent. Those sort of statistics are not very confidence inspiring at all.
No, not at all. No. And I think, some of that's, we know more now because of things like, it's easier maybe to exonerate people with things like, DNA testing. You shudder when you stop to think about all the innocent people that have almost certainly been executed in this country.
Once again, I'd like to thank my guest for their time and insight, and I'd like to thank you for listening to the Great Antidote podcast. The Great Antidote is sound engineered by Rich Goyette. If you have any questions, any guests, or topic recommendations, please feel free to reach out to me at thegreatantidote@gmail.com. Thank you.